the number one hit music station. More music, more variety. Welcome to The Alternative. Playing today's new country. Oh, sorry, I was just practicing. I'm Matt from Matt Fogarty Voiceovers. I know you want to listen to your podcast, so I'm going to keep this super brief. If you're a program director and you're looking for a fresh sound on your station, hit me up. I'll do a free, no-obligation sample for you, and you can get a really good sense for how I'll sound on your station. Get in touch at mattfogartyvo.com. I'm seriously sitting by my computer hitting refresh right now. Email me. Do it.
This is the Sound Off Podcast with Matt Kundle. Broadcast talk in Sound Off mode.
Live to a hard drive and downloaded manually to your iPhone or Android device, or even streamed straight from the cloud. This week, we will speak with David Phillips from Nlogic about all things pertaining to data. Think of it as a giant data dump or data redux, but this episode is going to change the way you look at your ratings and how you should see your radio station's brand. The Sound Off Podcast is brought to you in part by the new cloud-based paperless studio system, PromoSuite Next. For over 25 years, you've known PromoSuite as radio's original promotions management system, helping promotions teams and programmers manage their contest winners, liners, sales requests, remotes, prize fulfillment, and much more. Today, over 2,500 radio stations across the United States and Canada use PromoSuite Next to control the chaos, reduce paper, and reclaim the time you really want to spend creating great campaign concepts. To learn more, go to promosuite.com/soundoff.
If you're going to listen to a podcast, do it with the Sound Off.
Hello and good morning.
Hey, Matt, it's David.
Hi, David. How are you?
I'm well, sir. How are you?
That's David Phillips. Clearly, he's standing by. He's the president and COO of Nlogic. Now, if you're a regular listener of this podcast, you will surely recognize that Nlogic is a sponsor. My invitation for David to appear on this podcast was extended long ago, shortly after he appeared at a conference back in September of 2016. David essentially leads a company that delivers ratings information so buyers and sellers can get down to the business of doing business. And as the ad copy goes, Nlogic listens to both buyers and sellers in order to make the process go as smoothly as possible. And the latest update reflects that. Well, we will hear about that latest update. But David's take on data is refreshing and unique, as you'll hear when I reached him at Nlogic headquarters in Toronto. You know, David, we've got this title down. It came in on my calendar, and that's what is the future of radio? And
Right. That
question comes up at every conference. That question comes up every day. And we struggle with it, yet we don't have an answer for it.
Yes.
How do you see it?
Well, I do. There's a presentation I've taken out that I think sums up how I think about it, more or less, which is called It Needs a Reboot. If you look at the fundamentals of radio, they're really strong. So if you think about a reboot like the female Ghostbusters, what it did was take the fundamental core of the story, but then adapted how that story was told to, you know, meet the changed needs of today's audiences. And I think that's, if you think about radio, the core story is still really, really strong. The core story is radio creates these incredible connections with people. It creates these sort of communities, what I call communities of common interest. And that interest could be sports, it could be a certain type of music, it could be, and always usually is, the city you live in. But there's this community that's generated sort of weirdly organically. And radio, because it's like a person speaking in your ear, that creates a sort of intimacy around that community. And that's incredibly powerful, and that's incredibly valuable. So I think that core bit should stay the same. I think we, you know, the history is littered with companies who ran away from what actually they were good at in pursuit of the next thing. But I do think what radio needs to do, or needs to think about, is how it tells its story. So, you know, we spend a lot of time talking to agencies and to marketers, and it's undeniable that what they expect from media is different to what they used to even 3-4 years ago. So, you know, digital media has changed their expectations of what they should be receiving in terms of data, in terms of ease of purchase, in terms of all these kind of stuff. And I think that the opportunity for radio, the future of radio, is in thinking, more creatively and a more innovative and a more sort of humble way about how it can tell its story. And that's not just literally telling a story. I think that's how it interacts with buyers. You know, what's the medium it uses? How are campaigns operated? What control do people, are people able to have over the campaign once it's running, that kind of stuff. So the feature is, I think, a reboot. It's a strong core with some real thought paid to the innovation around how that story is told and how that story interacts with the market.
Is there a bit of a debate that would happen if we hit the reboot button over what constitutes radio? So is Apple streaming, they call it radio, they couldn't find another word for it. So is that radio? Is podcast, is that radio?
I'm not sure, and I'm not sure it really matters. I mean, I think, you know, if you boil down, one exercise I find interesting is sort of think about if radio was writing its CV, how would it describe itself to maximize what it looked like to its transferable skills? So, you know, when you're like, if you've been, I saw this fantastic example once of a convicted international drug smuggler, and he wrote his resume, and he said, look, I was convicted international drug smuggler. But he went, because of that, I have experience dealing in high-pressure situations and negotiating complex commercial arrangements. And you kind of go, well, yeah, that's absolutely true. You know, you sort of boil down the parts of being an international drug smuggler that actually would make sense in a regular business context. And so if you look at radio and you look at the whole gamut of audio, fundamentally they're about the monetization of audio content. So what we call it, I think it does matter. I think we have this, sometimes we have this rush away from like, we shouldn't call it radio, we should call it audio. I mean, I'm not sure about that. But I think the interesting thing to do is to stand back and go, okay, if my job at Newcap or Chorus or Bell, whatever, is to think about how I monetize this audio content, and I don't really mind what label you give that. But I think what is great and what would be great to see more of is different ways that people are looking to monetize their audio content. And I was at a conference a couple of years ago where I think it was Daniel Anstanding or someone said radio is sort of the only medium that effectively monetizes its content once. And, you know, you look at TV and the amount of money that content derives post the first time it airs, you know, syndication and repeat airings and, you know, streaming rights, all that kind of stuff. And in theory, at least, you kind of go, well, that there should be huge revenue post the first time that audio airs and on radio stations. So I'm not sure it really matters. And I think we also get too caught up in thinking about our competitive set being the same type of thing as us. So we tend to think, well, the biggest competitor to a radio station is another form of audio. I'm not sure that's true. I think we're always battling for share of attention. And the biggest competitor to radio could be, well, as well as things like nice weather outside, could be things like gaming or Twitter or Netflix. You know, Netflix recently said its biggest competitor was sleep. So I think the way we think about our competitive set should be broader than just something that seems adjacent to us.
That's fascinating. I've never really sort of looked at sleep being a competitor for Netflix.
Well, I think that's because we have this weird thing when we come into work where we sort of, our brains change from like how we think outside of work to how we think inside of work. So, you know, when you're at home, and this is, I find it psychologically and behaviorally just fascinating that like we're at home and we don't go, well, A, I don't describe my wife as a female 25-54, which maybe I should start doing just for fun. But we don't describe people in the way outside of work that we do inside of work. Nor do we go, I really could do with some audio content now. Am I going to turn on my radio station or listen to some podcasts? I go, what am I going to do with my time now? How much time do I have? If the kids go down at 9 or versus 8:30, what am I going to do with my time? Am I going to work out? Am I going to do some more work? Am I whatever? So we understand what a competitive set is intuitively when we're outside of work. And yet we come into work and we kind of fit ourselves into these weird categories and trammel ourselves along these weird lines where we go, well, the only competitor to radio must be streaming audio. And you're like, well, that doesn't make any sense. What, you know, what can radio do to compete against anything else that's trying to get its attention? I remember once when I was working in Vancouver with radio, with TV stations, and the TV stations were complaining because its ratings were lower than they thought they were, and this was in September. And unusually for Vancouver, it had been sunny for the first 3 weeks of the month. So my advice to them was wait until the first rainy day and see what happens. And the first rainy day hit and ratings went up 25%. You know, because the competitive set in Vancouver is the mountains. That's the challenge with Vancouver. And it's the same here. Not the mountains, but something similar.
Okay, before we go any further in this podcast, you need to understand that Numeris is the company that collects the diaries, people meters, and now online surveys that make up radio ratings in Canada. The company David is with is called Nlogic, and they create the software, like the cloud-based Lens, that allow you to read the ratings. So when I ask a question like his take about the recent inclusion of Numeris' online surveys...
Gosh, this is interesting territory for me to walk into.
He still answers the question quite convincingly.
Well, there's lots of things going on. So I think there's... And it depends how you see the data. So looking, standing back one step, it's clear that based on my understanding of what goes on in other markets, I spend a fair amount of time sort of studying other markets and conferences where I hear about other markets. Numeris does a fabulous job of doing what it's going to do. I think sometimes the conflict is, or some of the tension can arise from the fact that the data that Numeris produces is directly related to revenue. So when there's a change in the numbers, however legitimate that change is, it impacts revenue. And if there's a change to methodology that changes the numbers in a way that impacts revenue, then that's problematic for members, however legitimate the change or the methodological adjustment has been. So I think that's... I'm going to waffle around the question a little bit, but I think this the real problem is actually not the numbers, or the real problem is not... It's the fact that we've allowed all the value, or most of the value of radio stations, to be defined by a number. It doesn't matter how good that number is. I think that the sort of commodification of radio around a single number isn't helpful for anyone. And it's an easy question to pose and a difficult question to answer as to how we begin to uncouple such a direct relationship between those numbers and the revenue. Because the value of a station goes beyond how many people listen to it, radically beyond. And we all know that. And I think buyers know that too. It's just you need a number to facilitate a trade. So the way we think is like, well, if that number doesn't capture the entire value of a station, then what else could? And if the reason you have that number is because it's the easiest way to get to a trade quickly, then can we think of other ways that we could get to a trade quickly that expresses more of the value of a radio station? Because I think that's the fundamental question we need to answer. It's not really, well, how did the introduction of new methodologies affect the numbers? It's how do we adequately and properly capture the value of what radio does in a trade? That's a longer-term question that we need, that in cracking we would have really good returns on, I think.
And I think you gave a similar answer here in Winnipeg at a conference back in September. And it's, you know what? It's a great answer, because a lot of people were bothering you at this conference. I think this was at Red River College, and there's a lot of young people in the room, but it had to do with how we look at ratings. And a lot of people just look at the last book and say, that's who I am, and that's the number. And we really hang on that number probably more than we should, in terms of radio being a powerful medium. We should be trading on that rather than just the number.
Exactly. So, and this is where I think we've allowed a proxy to become the real thing. So, and I'm a massive fan of history, which makes me even more boring than you can possibly imagine. But I think you know, one thing that's just what's interesting when you study history is that I think it was G.K. Chesterton said, in order to break something, you need to understand why it was created in the first place. One was that, independent ratings were created because it's an issue of trust. So if I come up with numbers, and this is what Facebook and Google are quite rightly being criticized for now, is if you mark your own homework, then that seems a bit suspicious. So you need some kind of independent, disinterested party to come up with numbers. So that was the first reason why ratings were created. But a second reason was to facilitate a trade. That, like, if I go to you and say, buy 30 seconds of airtime, how on earth do I value that? And how on earth do I get to a point where you and I can agree on that? It's like saying, buy this square cubic foot of air. And you're like, okay? And I say, that's $5,000, please. And you think, I think that's $5. Like, how on earth do you value something that has no intrinsic value, which is time? So we created a number that was shared so people could get to a trade quickly. The trouble with that was a proxy for the value of the station. It wasn't the actual value of the station. It was designed to get to a trade quickly. And we've allowed that to overtake the real reason, which is, you know, the value of the station. Now, the interesting opportunity with technology is to go, okay, well, a lot of the reason we had a number is because we couldn't come up with stuff quick enough or that was sophisticated enough to capture the value other than here's how many people listen to it. I think now we can. Now we can come up with other ways of quantifying how valuable the relationship between a station and a listener is. And we can do so in a way that's fast enough to make it part of a trade. Because you could always do that before. You could come up with like long studies that said, here's how people feel about radio and whatever. The trouble was, it was never fast enough to become part of a trade. So now you can. So you begin to go, well, then we should start thinking about how we move beyond this. Let's remember this number is a proxy for the value, designed to solve a couple of specific issues that we, you know, we can probably solve in a different way now. Then you go, okay, if how else would we describe the value of a radio station and how do we build that into a trade? Because it actually works for both sides. It works for buyers and sellers to properly represent the value of something. And right now we don't. Do we believe that the connection that radio generates and fosters is valuable? Yes. Do we believe that capturing that relationship by how many people listen is sufficient? No. So what do we do about that? And that's when the industry can begin to have really interesting conversations and meaningful conversations that help the brands, that help the agencies, and that help ultimately the broadcasters.
I asked this question to Jeff Fidler, and it's a good one. It's about good data and bad data. Yeah. So how do you separate good data and bad data?
It's a question I wish everyone asked, and it's a question that on both sides of the aisle we could do a lot better job at. I think one is know where it's coming from. So, but I have a sort of training a deck on exactly this question: is how do you make sense of any data? How do you identify good versus bad? So one is you figure out where it's come from. Has it come from a machine? If so, is there a bias in the machine? I don't mean that in a kind of, you know, malevolent way, but like if something's coming from a mobile phone, then, well, not everyone has a mobile phone or that type of mobile phone. So know where it's coming from is a key thing. The second bit is in a way you have to also reframe the question around good and bad. So the core concept when you're thinking about any data, be that in your personal life or in work, is what are you trying to do with it? What's the purpose? And how good is that data at helping you in that purpose? So it's a question of fit for purpose. So, because you can have really sort of shaky data that's better at answering your purpose than really solid data. And I'll give you an example. If I'm trying to find out about how people feel about something, numerous data probably isn't the best place to go, even though it's super, super rigorous. It's, as I've said to clients before, with very few possible exceptions, it's the most rigorous data that you'll have in your shop. But if you're trying to find out how people feel about music, not the best at doing that. Or something that is less kind of statistically robust will give you a better answer. So, and again, it seems really obvious, but people don't do it. So they just go, well, I've got all this data available to me from Facebook, and then that's awesome. And you go, well, what are you trying to do with that data? Where does it come from? So it's about sort of examining where it's from, figuring out what you're trying to do with it, and then aligning those two together. And if people did more of that, they'd get a lot less confused by data, I think.
We're in the age of acceleration. Things change very, very quickly. There was a bit of a rush back in the mid-2000s to get PPM going. Now we have PPM going, but we've got another problem that's come up that a lot of people really don't talk about, and that's headphone listening. So if I'm listening on my headphones, the PPM's not picking this up. Now what?
Ghost of Numeris.
Ah, shit. All right, I did it again. I asked a question that singles out Numeris, and I want to be clear that I'm not asking these questions to find fault with any system. I'm asking them to find out how someone who works with data all day deals with the smaller aspects of what we consider flaws. The truth is, we can pick out flaws in any scoring system. And over time, it will evolve. The NFL moves back the point after attempt line. The NBA created a three-point line. Baseball added a designated hitter. Hockey, well, hockey's still trying to figure out goalie interference and icing.
Part of it goes back to the conversation we just had about how to figure out where data comes from. Is you go, okay, so one of the starting premises for that is there is no such thing as truth in data, and there is no such thing as complete data. So in other words, there is not a data set that exists in the world from anyone that tells you that doesn't have gaps. So Google's data has massive gaps in it. Twitter's data, we have no idea who the Twitter population is. Facebook data is just for those people. So, you know, everything has gaps. So the existence of gaps in data, or the potential of gaps in data, is universal. So every single data set has it. So the question then is not, well, does the existence of a gap create an insolvable problem? It's more acknowledging that gap, how do we fill it? Or how do we just work around the fact that there is a known gap? So, you know, because I run this business, what I'm often trying to do is use data to make decisions. And it's as helpful to me to know where I don't know things as it is to know where I do. Let's imagine a decision is 100%, okay? What I'm trying to do is get as high up that percentage as I can so I can be as sure as I can I'm making the right decision. So, and you know, again, that could be frankly like, should I marry this person? And what you're trying to do is like, you know, reduce the art in there and increase the science. How much can I know about how to answer this question? And so what data can do is fill in some of those gaps. The problem is that if people have some data, they tend to assume it fills all of that gap. That doesn't actually help you make a decision. It can send you off in the wrong direction. What's helpful is to know, well, 50% of this can be explained by data, but 50% can't. 50%, I'm just going to have to take a punt. So when you look at things like headphones and BPM data, again, I think you need to take a little step back to go, how much of this decision, how much of this landscape is explained by this type of data, which is basically a volumetric, is how many people are doing something. Then you go, okay, of that, how much am I missing, potentially, by people listening to headphones? Okay, I don't know. Let's put, you know, a few percentage points. Is there other data that I can use that would help me here? Even as a proxy, even if it just explains 50% of that 3% gap. Well, potentially. So I've got streaming data. So it's not exact, but it's, can it fill some of that gap? Because again, ultimately what you're trying to do, you're not trying to get this, you know, platonic ideal of everything is explained. You're trying to get enough data to help you make a decision. And that decision could be, do I invest more in streaming services? Do I need to explain the value of my station differently? Do I need to understand differently the value of what I'm buying if I'm buying airtime? So the problems or the challenges we have with things like PPM and headphones, they can get fixed on a methodological level, and they will be, you know, in some way, shape, or form. But that doesn't help people's life today. I think what helps people today is to go, let's sit back and understand the environment I'm trying to understand through data. Let's map out how much of this I can know. And if there's gaps, let's see if there's other ways I can fill this gap. And let's not forget that the point of this is, again, does this change what I'm going to do? Does this give me something I need to do differently? So in other words, does it mean I have to say something different to my buyer? Does it mean I have to say something different to my PD or to my talent? If it doesn't, then don't worry about it too much.
Yeah, and if we wanted to really get in, I mean, podcasting seems really simple. You download it, people listen to it, but there's no indication to figure out how long people have listened to maybe even this podcast. You know,
exactly.
There are people who have fast-forwarded through an answer to get to the next answer, and this is right now on this podcast. There are some people listening to find out if you said anything mean about them. There are some people who surf through to listen to find out if their name was mentioned.
Yeah, exactly. No, exactly right. And I think the other thing we do, which is really interesting, is that we, And again, this is, I think, a human characteristic that we forget that we carry through into work, is that we spend a lot of time obsessing about relatively small things because they're things we think we have some control over. Things we don't have that much control over or are really difficult, we just kind of pretend don't exist. So I'll give you an example about that. So one is, let's think about the effectiveness of advertising, or ROI, which everyone talks about all the time. Whenever you watch any survey or look at any study or read anything or go through any presentation about ROI, there's almost always one massive piece missing, which is what was the creative. So, and I'll give you an example. If someone said, free money at the bank tomorrow, you wouldn't need to run that ad many times. You could sort of like run it once. You wouldn't need to make it super snazzy. You wouldn't need to employ Ridley Scott to do the creative if you're doing a TV ad. It's a really compelling offer. So when you think about the ROI of advertising, the bits that probably impact its effectiveness have nothing to do with media, let alone, or very little to do with media, let alone which medium, which reach, which frequency, all that kind of stuff. It's what's the offer, what's the proposition, and what's the creative. But it's really, really, really difficult to quantify those three things in a comparable way. How do I quantify this offer from a bank versus this offer from a lawnmower vendor? Which one is more attractive? Well, I don't know, it depends. How do I quantify what good creative looks like? Well, gosh, I don't know, it's different horses, different courses. And so we just kind of pretend those things don't matter. And we spend loads and loads of time, and literally tens of millions of dollars, trying to figure out media effectiveness, even though it's probably the smaller portion of what indicates impact. We get caught up in these, but we feel we can control that and we can quantify it, so we spend lots of time talking about it, even though it's probably not the thing that affects things more. It's like word of mouth. Word of mouth has more impact on brand equity and awareness than anything else, and we spend very little time talking about it because it kind of just, I don't know, it's difficult and we can't really quantify it that well. It's odd. We have all these blind spots in our industry that we just don't even often think about that are more meaningful than the bits we spend loads of time shedding light on.
Last week, your company Nlogic unveiled some of the updates to Lens. So knowing and thinking about what I've heard from our conversation up to this point today, how do you incorporate this into a product like Lens?
So when we think about the future of radio, and this has sort of been a thread that's run through some of the things I said today, is that the way that radio is sort of interacts with the market is important for us to think about. So it's not just the core of, like, it's a really solid product and it creates these communities of common interest. It's also how easy is it for people to buy it? How easy is it for people to sell it? And I think one thing we've noticed, we've been around as a separate company for 11 years now. And one sort of common theme has been that the way that we've been able to sort of trade radio has held radio back. It's been too slow, the technology's not been good enough. And it's effectively led to a sort of inefficient and frustrating system. You know, as we had one big agency radio buyer who's a big fan of radio, but said that buying radio was seen as a loss leader within this agency because the process of doing so was so cumbersome and manual. So we go, okay, that's not good. So one of the things we're introducing with Lens is a way to cut that process radically down to make it more efficient. You know, we have a way of cutting the steps from 24 to 14. And so we kind of go, well, look, if we can liberate all this low-value, crappy work out of the system by automating a lot of this process, by making the actual process of buying and selling radio easier through Lens for Radio, that frees up time to have, you know, these conversations we've been talking about, but how do we actually really value radio? How do we get out of just, I'm going to give you this plan because this is the plan I did last year? Or, you know, if my rating went down 5%, then my revenue goes down 5%. Those aren't the conversations that an industry this powerful and this valuable should be having. So the way we can get to those conversations is through things like Lens for Radio, which frees up all this sort of low-value work of, like, re-inputting data and all this kind of nonsense. And because it's hosted on, it's a browser-based product, it's on Microsoft Azure, it's super quick, it works all the time, it's never been down, the Lens product has never been down since we launched it in April 2015 for a minute. So it's incredibly reliable, that kind of stuff. So So we're sort of very excited, if a little busy, about Lens for Radio and what it's going to do in terms of helping these conversations get better, reducing the low-value work that people, the drudgery that people have to do right now through old technology, and making that whole bit better. So there's lots of things that we can do, and we're thinking, you know, we're quite ambitious for the industry. We think there's a lot of things, a lot of different ways that we can talk about radio, a lot of different ways we can help radio in the mechanics around stuff traded. And we're only just getting started. There's so much opportunity because we've been held back for so long that we're really excited to see how things will go. And I'm a massive optimist and a massive believer in the opportunities that lie ahead for radio, because I think that the problems it has, not the problems, but the challenges it has are all eminently fixable. You know, if you go back to the reboot analogy, if you don't have a solid core, if your story is basically flawed, that's really difficult. You know, if you're just trying to spin a broken story, that's really difficult. If your story is fundamentally strong, which radio's is, then the bits that you need to kind of optimize, which is how you tell a story, are relatively simple. You know, and I don't mean to be mean, but we're not print. The fundamentals of the business are not, you know, doomed. Quite the opposite. So when we think about Lens, one of the reasons we have a two-year roadmap is because we've just set our three-year strategy, is because we're really optimistic about ways in which we can help broadcast a lot more of its value than it has done today.
So you're rebooting the way we get our data.
Yeah.
And radio really needs to reboot the way it really sees itself.
What is radio uniquely good at doing? And I think it's just, I keep going back to this idea of creating and fostering a community of common interest. And if you think about how good radio is at doing that, I live in Leslieville, which is a sort of, it's like a city for failed hipsters in Toronto. and I was at a local park attempting to play ball hockey with my boy. And he's relentlessly social, and which is awkward for a British introvert like me. And he went up to some other kids who were playing. And the dad was there, and the dad was Matt Hart, who's a presenter on Indy 88 in the morning. And, you know, we got chatting, and it was just wonderful talking to him about the community and the community that he fosters at Indy 88, and, you know, how connected he feels to it and how he's able to grow it and all that kind of stuff. And he goes, that is amazing, and that's happening in, you know, my wife's in Grand Prairie, that's happening in the five or six stations in Grand Prairie, that's happening in, you know, Medicine Hat, that's happening all over the country, in a way that radio is just fantastic at doing that. So it's not that radio needs to think of itself differently from that regard. I think it just needs to go, what can we do better to express our value internally? How can we generate more revenue in different ways from that incredible ability we have and that incredible equity we have? And how do we present that to the market in a way that matches the expectations of today's buyers, which is a platform, you know, that's modern and up to date, that gives them, you know, greater transparency in what's happening with their campaigns. And all these things are doable, and we're doing a lot of them. So that you know, we're just really optimistic about the days ahead.
And that's the podcast for this week. If you'd like to become a sponsor on the podcast, you can reach out to me through the website. If you're doing budgets, please consider using one of our current sponsors on your radio station. That's a nice indirect way to be supporting this podcast. Those people make this podcast free and available to you. My thanks to David Phillips for speaking so candidly. Another episode of this podcast is coming soon. See ya.
The Sound Off Podcast was produced by Evan Cerminski and recorded in the master studio of mattkundlevoice.com. Please rate and review episodes. It will help others find the show. To advertise on the podcast, email soundoff@mattkundle.com or download a rate card from the website and follow us and like us wherever great social media content is shared.
I'm Andrea Askowitz.
And I'm Allison Langer.
And we are the host of Writing Class Radio, a podcast, but we are so much more. We have writing classes. So if you are looking for live online classes where you can join a community, write to a prompt, get feedback, and get better, check out all our classes at writingclassradio.com and listen to our podcast wherever you get your podcasts and at writingclassradio.com.
Hi, I'm Logan Anderson, host of the Say the Damn Score podcast. On my show, I deep dive into the sports broadcasting business by, you guessed it, talking to sportscasters. The show has featured big names like Bob Costas, Kenny Albert, and Vern Lundquist, as well as many up-and-coming broadcasters who you may not know yet, but you will know soon. Whether you're looking for professional development as a sportscaster, different career paths, or if you just want to be entertained by hearing some of the best storytellers in the world tell their own stories, this podcast is for you. You can subscribe to the podcast on all major podcast platforms, or you can visit our website, saythedamnscore.com.